This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. When the COVID-19 pandemic was declared in early 2020, political leaders, state officials, and media pundits were at a loss as to the explanation of what was happening and how members of the public could protect themselves from a deadly disease. There was misunderstanding of the scientific method, of recommendations from government officials that were sometimes muddled, sometimes contradictory. While hindsight is always 20/20, in a crisis, how scientists communicate and how the public receives that information can be a matter of life and death. My guest is Christopher Reddy, a leader in the study of marine pollution and the development of environmentally friendly industrial chemicals. He's also a senior scientist in the Department of Marine Chemistry and Geochemistry at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute and faculty member of the MIT WHOI Joint Program in Oceanography. And he's the author of the new book, Science Communication in a Crisis, An Insider's Guide. Welcome to the program, Christopher.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate to be here.
So let's first talk about the big problem at the heart of much science communication, which is that scientists, when you're trained, aren't necessarily trained or even necessarily encouraged to communicate to the public, to non-scientists. How true is that? And why is that a problem?
I think it is true. I mean, I don't think the training is there. And I think the training that is often used is, while well-intended, is not where I would start. I think that would be the first step, is that we have a little bit of a gap in how we communicate science and how we train it. And, ultimately, we want a well-informed public. So our capacity to add what scientists can bring to the mix is invaluable as we move forward in a fruitful and meaningful life.
So tell me about the experience that you open your book with, which is that you were brought on as a scientist when the Deepwater Horizon oil spill took place a number of years ago, and it was a devastating oil spill. What happened? What was your role in the cleanup of that crisis, and what were the lessons that you learned that led you to writing this book?
Yeah, no, first of all, I'm an academic, so I'm not like a federal or industrial responder. You know, I'm an academic scientist who happens to be often in the mix in some respects. The Deepwater Horizon happened in the Gulf of Mexico in April of 2010, and oil leaked for 87 days, about 60,000 gallons an hour into the Gulf of Mexico. I got involved probably within the first couple of weeks, and I had my hand in a lot of projects, whether it was at sea or writing briefing documents, and I was working for the government a little with doing some consulting. But ultimately, I was involved in finding out how much oil was leaking, what its flow rate was, which was a big hot button question. Another big hot button question was these subsurface plumes, which were thought to be rivers of Hershey syrup floating underneath the ocean, which wasn't true. And then ultimately, I started to look at what happened to the oil once it was there. You know, how did nature respond to this uninvited guest, and where did it persist, and where did it break down, and what are the lessons learned we can use to move forward in understanding life on Earth as well as future oil spills?
And so what did you find in terms of how your information and words were either misinterpreted in the media, or how you struggled to communicate?
I mean, I was lucky. I mean, I had a lot of media training, and I already worked on, several oil spills. So I had already made my share of mistakes, but I continued to make some, a lot of them. I mean, I would say, most importantly, I think we often think about communicating science, scientists is talking to the media. But I think that there's much more value speaking to individuals, to people, because I think they matter the most. And I think if you can make those direct connections, and you can make them meaningful, and you can make them, that's where you make that strong bond with science. And I think that it also makes you a better scientist and a better person. And I've learned a lot from talking to people when their lives and livelihoods are on the table. That's where it's the most valuable. And it's also where I've made the biggest mistakes. You know, I discounted somebody's a little lesion on their arm. You know, she was firmly believed that it came from the dispersants that were used to combat the spill. And I was dismissive. She just wanted me to listen. And, you know, we almost got beat up running off the beach. Other times, you know, a lot of empathy and listening will go a long way for a scientist. And I was reminded of that frequently during Deepwater Horizon.
It is a big part of the problem that science itself is a process of discovery, and therefore, at all times, a good scientist, knows what they don't know, which doesn't make for good communication in a pithy way and in, you know, in a sound bite.
It is. Excuse me. I mean, first of all, you know, I think sometimes we're too hard on scientists. And I think the public is unreasonable, and in part because they don't understand how science works. You know, we're in a world where you can whip out your cell phone, your iPhone, and find out what the weather is halfway around the world and whether or not you can buy a plane ticket to get there in 15 minutes. You know, our society loves certainty and they like things coming fast, right? Scientists are very comfortable in uncertainty and understand that slow is good. It builds in a lot of ways in which I think science has a really great track record compared to other aspects of life, whether it's the stock market or politics. I think we do a very good job of keeping ourselves in lanes. And so a lot of these challenges is simply because folks don't understand how science works in our culture, that we are comfortable with uncertainty. In fact, if something is certain, we're not going to study it.
Right. And in fact, being certain or jumping to conclusions can be a career breaker. It can, you know, when one takes a little bit of data and arrives at a strong conclusion, and finds out shortly thereafter with more data that one is wrong, your reputation is in tatters, and rightly so. So that, of course, makes scientists scared to to draw clear conclusions. And we saw that on full display during the early months of the pandemic, right? When nobody really had any idea what this new virus was about, how it would spread, and how it could kill. And and people expected scientists to know all the answers right away, and they didn't.
Well, I mean, I think first of all, and I think you probably have an appreciation of this, we cannot thank all the scientists, engineers, and healthcare professionals and responders for how they worked tirelessly to make this bad thing from getting worse. And I can't imagine how hard all these folks did, and whether it's nurses or all, you know, I just really have to drive home to people how hard it is to do that work when you're worried about getting sick. But after that, I think the challenges for a scientist early on is this idea, and returning back to you said that we want to tell everybody what we don't know. And that's because we think we're talking to our peers, right? Our peers, we want to have this sense of comfort, like, you know, listen, this is what we don't know, this is what we're working on. Where in reality, the public is hungry for knowledge, and you got to lead with what we know and what we think we're going to know in a week, what we don't know, and how this is going to play out. And I think it would have helped out a lot if we could play it out like that in the early days of COVID. Like, this is what we have. This is what we know. These are things I think we'll know in a couple of weeks. These are things we don't know. And you know what? It's not that bad if we don't know. The world's not going to end. You know, we're just going to keep on doing what we can do. And I think it would have been really valuable in April of 2020 for folks to explain how science works and that it's not a sporting event. You know, this paper did this and that paper did that, and who won and who lost. That doesn't how science works. You know, it's incremental, it's self-correcting. We build on, you know, theories and work for many of our colleagues, and that just doesn't jive often with folks outside of science.
So, what can the role of science communication be during a crisis like the COVID-19 pandemic? You have to walk a fine line, don't you? Because the public is relying on the best possible information, but the public needs to be also aware of the fact that those guidelines that are being put out at any given time could change in a week or in a month. And when they do change, they would change for good reason. I mean, that's an incredibly complicated thing to communicate.
No, it's true. And I think there's even one more context that, I think boils down to a lot of the challenges in going back to this Monday morning quarterback idea is that often I hear folks go, well, they said this and, that was wrong, or they did this and that was wrong. And, the way you want to frame this kind of rewinding the tape is to look at who made that decision and what was it based on with the available knowledge that they had. So there are folks out there who will cherry pick some statement, say, well, we made that statement and that directive because this was the data that they had in hand, that they didn't have any data, they didn't have enough time. But the key thing is that the people in the room who made that recommendation were the people you want to be in that room, right? And so that was the challenge that I think we wanted to really drive home is, look, we are working on trying to make a bad thing from getting worse. We have limited time. We're going to work with what we have, and we're going to continue to update you. But there isn't any happy ending here. We're trying to make this big fire be less of a big fire. And I think that would have helped out. But at the end of the day, when your lives and livelihoods are on the table, it's still hard to rationalize when you don't know what next week's going to be. Or next month, are you going to get sick? You're going to lose your job, and all those other aspects. So, COVID, in many respects, is an unusual outlier, but still, nevertheless, really identified some challenges that we have in communicating science and educating the public about how science works.
And of course, the pandemic hit at a time when information travels or misinformation travels at lightning speed. And there was so much incorrect information out there, and there continues to be because of the nature of the algorithms that preference sensationalist material in social media platforms. You can have a whole discussion about the profit motive and its fueling of misinformation. But do you worry, especially that coming out of the COVID-19 crisis, even though so many lives were saved because of good scientific guidance, because of the development of life-saving vaccines, that we do have this huge problem now of a significant portion of the public that believes vaccines are bad for you or that can ruin your health. We have a potential presidential candidate who is going to be running on a supposedly progressive platform that sadly includes anti-vaccine propaganda. And it seems as though that is going to be an outcome of the COVID-19 crisis that we're going to be cleaning up for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to wrap your head around it. As a fan of science and scientists, and to look at how the vaccine was rolled out, developed, through implemented, and then the dramatic success it was, and then to still see naysayers is just heartbreaking. I mean, it's heartbreaking, personally. It's heartbreaking for society. It's heartbreaking for science. It's heartbreaking for all these people who invested their lives doing it. I think. I'm not a mental health or expert in sociology, psychology, or all these other things. I'm just a chemist. But I do think that when we have these types of discussions about pushback about science, what we don't want to do is lecture people. We don't want to show them Excel graphs, and we don't want to show them tables with p values and all this other arcane, ways to communicate science, which are not going to work. So I think we want to start to look very closely about why are folks pushing back on vaccines. Listen to them, try to create some type of conversation, and work from there. But it's clear that when folks are presented with the re analytical results of the vaccine success, and they're not buying in, they're not going to buy in next week. So we got to figure out how you communicate and get this information to the people so it's meaningful, whether it's how it touches their own lives and their families or any other way. But we cannot lecture to people who don't want to be lectured to.
Earlier, you mentioned that you prefer speaking with individuals rather than the media. However, journalists and media there
Oh
to
yeah.
be able to
Yeah. I
translate
wasn't dismissing you.
information to the public, right? I mean, that's the role because there's only so many individuals you could talk to on an individual level. So getting
Yeah.
information out in a mass media format is important, especially during a crisis. But the problem is, not only do scientists not have much training in communicating and coming to conclusions or expressing their conclusions in a clear way. Journalists, there's that extra level of interpretation, don't necessarily have the science training to be able to relate the information. Then you've got political leaders who have their own set of goals and
Yeah.
filters and lenses, and at the end of it all is the public who needs to receive that information in ways that makes a difference to them. So what advice can you give first to journalists and then to political leaders who take information from scientists and you would like to see them treated responsibly?
Yeah. Well, I would start off by saying that often when there is scientists talk about the media, they're vilified. And we think about them as, they get it wrong, and they don't like the byline and things like that. I think we have to appreciate that actually journalists are a lot closer to scientists than we think. They just have to work on a much faster timeline of 8 hours to become an expert and have a beginning, middle, and the end.
I feel
But I think
seen.
that, pardon me?
I feel seen.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we have to appreciate the fact that scientists are hungry to know something and they want to tell a story with it, and that's what journalists do. And I think that we could create a much stronger bond between scientists and journalists. More often than not, when I've been in a lot of training where they train scientists about how to communicate. I have to tell you that a lot of times it leaves me very frustrated because a journalist will come in or a communication specialist and they'll lecture to the scientist of all the things that they're doing wrong. And sometimes we need to have the journalist say, hey, this is my life. This is how I get paid. This is what I call success. And I think on the flip side, a scientist has to explain to a journalist the rules of science and that this is why we won't say this. This is why we're worried about saying this because this is how our currency and how we're valued. And so at the end of the day, you can have a much more successful exchange between journalists and scientists if we had a better appreciation of each one of our jobs and our cultures and what we consider success. And my recommendation to scientists and journalists is to start local. You don't exchange business cards at a crisis. And if you want to start getting your feet wet, you want to start building skills about how to communicate, I would start local media, speaking to your fire department, your police department. The risks are much lower. And you'll have a better chance of developing relationships. And those relationships, and it's been shown many times, having relationships at the local level, not being able to just walk down to Washington, D.C. and testify, the local level is where you cut your chops. And that's where you can make an impact. Because if you become the local expert on COVID, as a general rule, from what I've learned, and is that if you're a local and you're the expert, you're more likely to impact your neighbors. They're much more likely to hear from you than somebody who lives around the other side of the world.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Christopher, for joining us today. Good luck to you with your book. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. I had a great time.
My guest is Christopher Reddy, a senior scientist in the Department of Marine Chemistry and Geochemistry at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and author of Science Communication in a Crisis, an Insider's Guide, the book we've just been discussing. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.